Happy Father's Day, everybody. One more announcement. A few weeks ago, I sent out an email just mentioning that this property next to store was up for sale. Sherry Yamamoto was been praying faithfully for God to give us that property, which I think is the sweetest thing ever. And then that fence came down, and we're like, oh, this would be awesome. But it was like happening so quick that we're like, there already was offers. And we were like, well, God, if we're supposed to even consider this, we just would pray for more time. And Marcy, the woman selling it next door, said, all those buyers fell through if you guys are still wanting to talk about it. And a number of you have come up to me and said, we'd be interested in that conversation. And so if that is you, you're invited to our house on Thursday night, 7 p.m., to discuss and pray. And we might even go walk over there and take some time to just sort of pray over what God might be doing. So anyway, that's it. It's a reach, but isn't everything in this day and age? So anyway, we'll just see what God's doing. Happy Father's Day. Again, I said it already, but I thought maybe I would just start with a dad joke because it's Father's Day. I know. I don't really know any good jokes, but that's kind of the point, right? You're like, what does a pirate say when he turns 80? I'm 80. Yeah, let that one soak in. It's so good. Right. I mean, our fathers, this is part of the job, right? Fathers are supposed to just sort of, in a way, create a sort of lightness that makes us all groan. You know, when you think about fathering and what really is at the heart of it, I think something that I've mentioned this to you guys before, but something that meant a lot to me and made me think of my own father, I took from this guy, Edwin Friedman, who's written a lot about leadership, but he was a rabbi, and he saw this kind of energy of a father being really at its core what he would call non-anxious presence. He's saying that is the strength of a father there, a non-reactivity, a sense of stability, a kind of quiet humility that is able to endure. I think about my dad, and we had moved up to the local mountains, grew up near Lake Arrowhead, Crestline up in that area, and it meant a commute for him. And then the place that he was working, they closed that plant, which meant that his commute was like twice as far. And hours my dad would spend in carpools and all of that. And I was thinking, I never once, ever heard him complain about it. I mean, you should hear me when I have to deal with like a little bit of traffic. And I'm like, oh, I'm dying. My dad would never complain. And I think of that like non-anxious presence, that stability. And I think I'm so grateful for that example in my life. And honestly, I know that Mother's Day, Father's Day, there's complexity to that because some of us are in desperate need to be re-parented. That often we had childhoods where we weren't supported well or we weren't loved like we should. And to realize a lot of times what we are experiencing in church is a way that God comes in and faithfully re-parents us in such a way. And for those of us who are in those roles and stumbling along doing the best we can, the way that God calls us to more and more, shapes us into more of those the kind of hearts that can give in such a way. So that really would be my prayer for this morning as we go into this message, this kind of non-anxious strength that is being exhibited here. I just pray that that spills over into us on this Father's Day. I've been so enjoying going through the book of Philippians, and it's a great book anyways, but Paul, I think, this is some of his very best teaching in the sense that it's so precise, so directed in. And he starts with this prayer that I've been repeating each week because to me it encapsulates his heart as he's reading this letter, writing this letter that is being read to his church. He's going, this is what I want you guys to get, and it comes by way of a prayer. He says these words. He says, I pray this, that your love will keep on growing in knowledge and every kind of discernment, so that you may approve the things that are superior and may be pure and blameless in the day of Christ. This idea that our love grows in knowledge and discernment to know the superior things that we might be pure and blameless in the day of Christ. No, I'm not sure how many of you have ever thought, gosh, I would love to be pure and blameless. Anybody? I mean, most of us know, like, that's like long gone, right? Like, we've crossed that line a long time ago. But this is one of the things that Scripture just throughout holds up in front of us, that this is what is being offered, pure and blameless children of God. And I was thinking, if I had to come up with some sort of like catchy YouTube tag, I would title this sermon like this: here's the one thing you need to stop doing in order to be pure and blameless. What is the one thing? Well, I'm going to tell you, right? So you click that link, don't you? You click that link and you're like, tell me, what's the one thing? And you're like, why isn't he telling me? And he's talking about like, oh yeah, this is what nobody wants you to know, but I'm going to tell you. And you're like, tell me. And he's like, no, here's an ad, right? And you're like, okay, sit through the ad. And then you come back in, now he's going to tell me, here's the one thing you need to stop doing. And he's going to keep meandering. And you know what I'm talking about? Or am I the only one who just falls for these things? And at this point, you're like, I've watched 3 ads. So you're like, I have to watch this all the way to the end because I'm like 10 minutes into this stupid video. And you realize by the end, he's not going to tell me. Well, I'm going to tell you the one thing you need to stop doing, but I'm not going to tell you right now. I'm going to wait. And this is known, and I'll tell you for a reason. I looked this up, like, why? Why do they do this? And they're like, oh, there's a name for it. Of course, there's a name. The Zygarnik effect was named after this Russian guy who had observed this kind of psychological tendency that he's basically saying people, for whatever reason, remember uncompleted ideas more than they realize completed ones. So it's in your interest for me to keep you hanging. So I'm not trying to torture you, but this one thing, you're going to have to hang on before I get to it. But it's the thing. Paul's going to come in and he's going to be really specific. And if you've been following along, you realize that that's actually different than the way that he's been speaking up till now. We talked about this last week, that Paul is continually speaking in this way that is paradoxical. That we want there to be just one thing. We want that simple answer, like fill in the blank. And he's going, well, it's this and this. It involves this and it involves this. Paradox. These things that might even feel like they're opposed or at opposition to each other are actually both important. For example, we just talked about this at the beginning of Philippians 2. He's saying this is the way of Jesus. It's this way of emptying. It's this way of humility. It's this way of letting go of ambition and conceit. You need to release all that so that it will lead you to glory. Glory, like more glory than you can imagine, like shining like a star. And we're like, wait, which one is it? Is it humility or is it glory? Paul's going to say, yes. It's both of these things. In fact, they're intertwined with each other, that these paradoxical truths, they take us to like the limit of our ability to understand, and then they reveal that there's more. This is how revelation works. It breaks through these ceilings of understanding for us to understand, oh my goodness, the truth is bigger than I realize. Last week we talked about this paradox. Who is at work? Is it me or is it God? Is it like my will or is it God's power? And last week Paul said, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And you're like, got it. It's me. And he says, because it's God who's at work to will and work to his good pleasure. And you're like, once again, paradox. Is it me? Yes. Is it God? Yes. So we would go like 50-50. And he's like, no, 100-100. Like all in both of those things. And I think our temptation when we hit paradox is to oversimplify, to just pick. All right, I'm going to pick free will or I'm going to pick sovereignty. Right? And what we do is it costs us something. If you're a free will person, then God's not in control. If God is in control, then it doesn't matter what I do. And Paul is saying, wrong. It's both of these things, fully realized. That tendency to pick one or the other. In philosophy, we would refer to this as Procrustean. Now, Procrustes was a Greek bed maker. I've told you this one before. Procrustes would make beds, and he would make them exactly to fit, right? Which is perfect. I mean, being 6'4", I always like hang, my feet always hang off the bed. And so I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'd love one of his beds. And he'd go, great, Jeff, lay down. And then he'd chop my feet off. perfect, right? This is what Procrustean thinking does. It makes it fit, right? But at a cost. And you're like, oh, that's exact. And you're like, except there are feet on the ground. This idea of what we do with truth, when we pick, it's not we're going to eliminate the paradox and just make it work. And generally what we do is we lose something vital. So we're constantly being beckoned to think bigger, larger, outside of our box, that we understand that God's truth is bigger than our own, to resist that temptation to oversimplify. And wouldn't it be great if you could just then go, well, okay, so all truth is paradoxical, except that, interestingly enough, Paul goes, not this one truth. This one is black and white. Isn't that sort of paradoxical? All truth is black and white, or all truth is paradoxical, except this, or except this, right? There's always an exception to the rule. But for Paul, he's saying this thing is black, and you need to get rid of it at all costs. This one thing, you need to go after it like it's cancer. That there's no like, it's just a little bit of cancer, right? You're like, no. If that's there, we wipe it out. Why? Because it grows, it contaminates, it spreads. So he's going, get rid of this thing, whatever that one thing is, that thing that I'm waiting to tell you. Okay, and I'll tell you. And as I do, some of you are probably thinking to yourself, oh, I think I probably know what it is. But unsurprisingly, this is one of those things that I'm guessing wouldn't be the first thing to come to mind for you. Get rid of this one thing. You think, well, anger or lust, even like arrogance. Nope. For Paul, he's saying, here's the one thing. Get rid of it at all costs. It's grumbling. How many of you were thinking it was grumbling? No hands. Grumbling. He's going, get rid of it. Don't let those words come out of your mouth. If you do, the result will be a heart that is pure and blameless. So let's look at our passage today, and then we're going to kind of unpack all of this. But Philippians 2, and I'm going to back up into our last week's paradox here in verse 12, but our main passage is going to be 14 through 18. It says this, therefore, my dear friends, therefore, Paul is getting to his point here. He says, therefore, my dear friends, just as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but even more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who is working in you both to will and work according to his good purpose. Do everything without grumbling and arguing, so that you may be blameless and pure, children of God who are faultless in a crooked and perverted generation, among whom you shine like stars in the world, by holding firm to the word of life. Then I can boast in the day of Christ that I didn't run or labor for nothing. Even if I am poured out as a drink offering on the sacrificial service of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with all of you. In the same way, you should also be glad and rejoice with me. The word of the Lord. Now, what is Paul answering right here? Well, he's starting with this in verse 12. Here's what you do. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. How do we do this? Some of what he's told us already. It's a humility. It's an emptying of ourself. It's not clinging to our rights or clinging to our ambitions or our conceits. It's considering others more important than ourselves. Learning to respond with a sense of service and sacrificial love. But here, as we're going, how do I work out my salvation? It's like, stop grumbling. Stop murmuring. Stop gossiping. Now, if you're like me, you're like, grumbling? Seriously, like, what's the harm in a little grumbling? Right? It's actually kind of fun. Like, you come back and you're like, you know what bugged me today? Oh gosh, this was so annoying, you guys. Right? Whatever that thing is that comes to mind, right? How was your day? Oh my gosh, you're never going to believe what so-and-so did. This is what grumblers do. They spot that thing that just sort of bugged you, right? And we think, oh, it's no big deal. Maybe in some ways it even feels constructive. Like, you know what I noticed? That like this person blew it today. Why did they do that? Or why did they, right? We find that thing that you're like, they shouldn't have done that. That was stupid. Or maybe we find ourselves thinking, I just need to vent something, right? I just need to blow off some steam. So like, I'm just gonna say it, right? Or maybe even we find ourselves connecting by doing it. Have you ever experienced that? Like, it's a way to sort of draw close to somebody to go like, did this bug you? And they're like, oh, that totally bugged me. And you're like, oh, we both get it, right? That there's a name for. They would call it like common enemy intimacy. It forms a connection, right? It's like, feels good to gossip. We're like, we both find that person annoying. And like, it actually is toxic to relationships. But that false enemy intimacy leaves you with a feeling of actually like insecurity. It destroys trust. Why? Because you know that person is probably just as easily going to throw you under the bus when they're with so-and-so. That gossip has this way of giving us sort of a short, like saccharine release of happiness, but really leaves us wanting. Which is basically what sin does every time. It promises one thing and then robs us of that very thing. But this way of thinking, even if it's small, it has this way of growing. That there in sort of the dark within our hearts, it expands and grows. And this idea, this grumbling that takes place there, if you were reading along in this, you would already have placed this with an Old Testament story. This would be a common way for the Israelites to write in their sort of poetic way. They'll make mention of certain words, and Paul packs a bunch of these into these four verses that we're looking at today. And murmuring, that word would have taken them right back to the Exodus. That this story of Moses coming in and liberating the people from slavery, we know this story. And this kind of tragic aspect to that story where they wander and wander and wander in the wilderness. You've probably heard this before if you've been at church for any period of time, but you know how long it would have taken Israel to go from Egypt to the Promised Land? Like 2 weeks max. Said they wandered 40 years. A whole generation of people died off before they reached that Promised Land. And the reason why we see again and again reference to the fact that they grumble. In their situation, they see what is wrong, not what is right. They forget about what God did in the past, and they end up despairing over what's going to happen tomorrow. This complete lack of trust or faith in who God is, and as a result, they complain. In Exodus 16, 2 through 3, it says, the entire Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt when we sat by pots of meat and ate all the bread we wanted. Instead, you brought us into this wilderness to make this whole assembly die of hunger. Do you know anybody like this? This complaining, this despair, this like self-pity. In Philippians, this word that in the Greek is gagaismos, and it means murmuring, discontent, secret displeasure, internal discontent that simmers below the surface. And this way, this like festering right there, is like an infection that grows. I read this as a definition of grumbling. It says, grumbling is more than just casual complaining. It's a posture of the heart that reveals distrust, ingratitude, and rebellion against God's provision, timing, or leadership. Have you felt that? It happens when we experience discomfort, uncertainty, unmet expectations. I think about this for myself anytime like I get lost. If I feel like I know what I'm doing, then I'm like calm and cool. But the second I get lost, there's this like, this irritability that sets in. Different behaviors that come up, the words that come out of my mouth, the impatience, the state of my heart. That it's revealing something when I grumble. The posture, the lack of trust. I read a book years ago called Blink. Did anybody read Blink by Malcolm Gladwell? And in this book, he makes reference to this survey that's been done by Gottman. And what he's trying to illustrate in this example is something that he calls thin slicing. And thin slicing is this way to come, like, almost take a sample of something and determine its quality, like determine what's at the heart of this thing. You can just take a thin slice. And so Gottman would say this. They would come in and they would be like, within 15 to 30 minutes, we can decide with 90% accuracy whether or not you'll be divorced 5 years from now. That was the claim. And the statistics proved that they were right. Within 15 to 30 minutes, they can thin slice your relationship and decide whether or not you are going to make it 5 years. And the thing that they look for, Gottman would say, is contempt. And that it showed up in the smallest little ways, even in the humor. It was a tone. It was a suggestion, even a sort of nonverbal that would go off. They'd see it and they'd be like, okay, interview done. It was that fatal that this thing, and again, they're not trying to come in with judgment, like shame on you. They're just going, oh, that's a relationship killer. And Gottman identified like four different really communication styles that would reveal this. And I have these down here for you guys. Criticism, attacking the person rather than the behavior. Defensiveness, self-protection that avoids responsibility. Stonewalling, withdrawing emotionally or shutting down. And contempt, which was the most destructive of all, which communicates that one partner sees themselves as morally or intellectually superior. It could be eye-rolling, mocking, sarcasm, a sort of sneering tone. These patterns, right, they're again, not even trying to offer suggestions or to come in and fix. They're just going, when those things are noticed, they're like, if those things, if left to themselves, prove fatal to intimacy. Gladwell writes, contempt is closely related to disgust. And what follows from disgust is the desire to exclude, to avoid, and to expel. As we're doing this sort of grumbling, it's revealing something very dangerous to ourselves, to all our relationships, not just to marriage. In the end, a relationship to God, and even a relationship to ourselves. When we speak to others with contempt, guaranteed we speak to ourselves with a similar sort of contempt. When we protest about God and God's faithfulness, deep inside of us is revealed our own insecurity and our own self-loathing. And so dealing with this, paying attention to this, rooting this out of our life, becomes for Paul something that we do with fear and trembling. We're working out our salvation by avoiding this at all costs. Now just for clarity's sake, I came up with four examples of what grumbling can look like. And if you're like me, you kind of see yourself in all four. But the first one, the whiner, someone who habitually complains, especially in a sort of high-pitched, self-focused, and repetitive way, often about inconveniences or perceived unfairness. It's not fair. You ever feel that? Like, oh my gosh, this is so not fair. Why do they get that, right? Why did that person get the promotion and not me? I do so much more than that person does. Why is that person getting all the attention? Why did they get that gift that I know I need more than they do? I deserve more than they do. And we just, right? You can just almost hear the frequency of the whine. It's not fair. Often that's a pursuit of some sort of pity that we're looking for, that we'll settle for that, even though we're not maybe being loved. We'll accept pity instead. Or maybe you're the victim. A victim is someone who internalizes hardship or disappointment as proof that they are uniquely cursed or forgotten. I love this one. Why me? Like, nobody understands what it's like to be me. No one appreciates me. This is where the victim lives, right? It's a way of self-protection, right? I'm the only one who gets it. Or the cynic, Cynic is someone who responds to disappointment or disillusionment by adopting a posture of detachment, skepticism, sarcasm. And it's this way of just protecting ourselves when we feel vulnerable, when we feel like potentially exposed to some sort of frustration or disappointment. We're like, I don't even care, right? I don't even care. Or, you know what? Nothing ever changes, right? It's this way of like bravely accepting disappointment as the norm. It's kind of like that phrase, it's the hope that kills you, right? It's this way of living, like putting up some sort of protection by pretending that my heart's not in it. Or maybe the perfectionist. Perfectionist is someone who sees the world through this lens of unattainable standards and responds to imperfection with criticism, control, or contempt. Like, is that the best you can do? Seriously? Or this one, God, you know what? You just can't fix stupid. Right? Like, here's what's wrong, here's what needs to be done, and none of you are going to do it. Right? You can see the way cynicism blends in with these things. All of these are the postures of grumbling, murmuring, complaining. All of these postures are things that the more we do them, the more natural they become. The more that we get stuck in a sort of rut of complaining. And as these things go on year after year after year, they become more and more who we are, not just what we do. When I think of our world, I just go, this tendency to like live in this place of unmet expectations. We're surrounded by it. And I think this is what underlies so much of complaining. I thought it was going to be this way, and it turns out reality is this way. Have you felt that? I mean, how many of your lives look the way you thought they were going to? All of us have had some sort of like expectation or course only to have it interrupted or disappointed. Something that like comes in that catches us off guard. And when we do, our tendency is to complain instead of understanding that this is an opportunity for us to grow. What we do instead is just settle into this place of compare and disappointment, and it breaks our hearts. We end up dwelling on that. One of the main paradoxes about our country in general is that we have more than we ever did, and we're sadder than we've ever been. I think of this story of when Mother Teresa first came to America, and she was asked, what is it like? I mean, she's coming from this place of total poverty into this place of such affluence. And she said, what do you think of America? And her response, do you remember this? She said, I just noticed that all of you are so sad. We're like, but we have everything, right? Our metric of success is so high. But when we look at our hearts, you're like, we live in this place of disappointment. We live in this place of like not measuring up. And now what we've done is we've created this really efficient way of feeling even more disappointed, and it's called social media. That's constantly showing how your life doesn't match up to the way it should be. If only I was more beautiful, or if only I had that car or that job or was in that beautiful place in Bali surfing that wave, whatever. I don't know what's your feed. That's like mine. Like, oh, I should be surfing there. Like, right, these are the things that come up and you're like, oh, I was surfing like cruddy Oak Street today. And if only I was in Bali, then I would be happy and filled with joy, right? This way of creating this distortion between real life and the expected life. And we live in this place of unmet expectation, in this place of not enough, and it's like they're pouring gas on this thing. What we find is us, we come away from those sort of experiences feeling even more lost. And this expectation gap, so much of Scripture is trying to correct in us. It's reminding us that life is difficult. In fact, the way to glory is this way downward. It's a way of letting go of comparison. It's a way of letting go of envy. Not chasing after these things. Because Paul's going, this is going to give you the actual metric of success, which is a heart that is filled with joy. And you can have it. All you have to do is this one thing. Stop grumbling. That joy is available. That a life of deep meaning and purpose is there. What you need to do is serve others. Consider others more important than yourself. Empty yourself of this insistence on my way. Trust in the fact that God knows the way to abundance. So stop speaking those things out, because you're doing damage internally and externally. Our words just like start fires. We think that little thing that we said, not really taking into account the effect. James 3 talks so much about this. It's saying the tongue is a small part of the body and boasts great things. Consider how a small fire sets ablaze a large forest. And the tongue is a fire. The tongue, a world of unrighteousness, is placed upon our members. It stains the whole body, sets the course of life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. The truth is, our grumbling does nothing good. That our murmuring, our complaining, our constant negativity is not fixing anything. We live in a world that is broken, and we need to live in a world that desperately needs light to shine, but this is not the way we do it. It just multiplies harm. When we complain and we blame and we point the finger somewhere else, number one, we can't fix those things anyways, right? You can't fix somebody through complaining. You might be able to manipulate for a time. But the gossip, it just does harm. I've heard this story one time, and of course, like every good story, it involves a rabbi. But there was a rabbi, and somebody, one of their parishioners came to them and said, "I've been gossiping about you, and I'm so sorry." And the rabbi said, "Oh, that's okay. What I want you to do is take a pillow to the top of a mountain. I want you to just tear open that feather pillow and just let the feathers fly." So they do, and they rip it open. It feels very cathartic. Those feathers go flying everywhere, and they come back, and they're like, "Okay, I did what you did, what you told me to do. Would you forgive me?" And he says, "I will, but first go pick the feathers up, and then I will forgive you." Right? That these little sparks are just burning, right? And we go, "Oh no, it's spread." Paul's saying, you do so much damage when you do this. Just be careful, little mouth, what you speak. But the truth is, too, and again, what everything is pointing towards in Scripture, I feel like ultimately is about the heart. And he's saying, when you do this, you're doing internal harm. You're creating a hardness in your heart. If you were part of our great divorce study, we read through Lewis's Great Divorce, and it's about this bus ride of people that are in hell that are visiting heaven for the day. And they come up and get to experience all this. And each one of them is like defined by a certain sin in their life. And this one woman that gets off is the grumbler. And in this conversation about her, it's referenced that she was a grumbler, but has become a grumble. And Lewis, like he does so well, says, "Hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining, always blaming others. But you're still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish you could stop, but there may come a day when you can no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood or even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine." This is what happens. This is how our hearts become formed in these patterns through repetition. It's shaping who we are, and that grumbler eventually just becomes a grumble. And here in this, he's saying, if that bothers you, good, because that means you can course correct, that heart is not hard, that God's desire is that we would become what? Pure and blameless children. That God is saying, I want to reverse that process, not just halt it, but reverse it, to making you a heart that is soft and humble and gentle, a heart capable of loving the greatest things. When Paul talks about what that heart is like, he uses two words. He says it's patient and it's kind. This is the kind of heart that God wants to form in us. And as it turns out, like, this is the kind of heart that lives in this place of joy, that's able to release expectations and just live in that posture of trust. John 16:33, these beautiful words of Jesus, he says, "I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. You will have suffering in this world. Be courageous. I've conquered the world. And this whole book is set in light of an eternal kingdom, a future of yours that extends beyond death, a reality of Jesus making all things new, our hearts being one of those things. That what awaits us is a heart that is pure and soft and gentle. And he does this by lavishing us with grace. And he's saying that grace will bring your heart back to life. It will soften your heart. But what it will do is it will allow that to be what spills out of you. That you become this like receptacle for grace that you then pour out. Paul's going to refer to this as like the completion of his life is being poured out, this vessel being poured out. That so much of our life is spent shaping this vessel, but ultimately in the end, not to be kept for us, but to be emptied, that the joy is found in the hospitality of extending this grace to others. And this defies the way the world works. I love how Simone Weil says, all natural movements are governed by gravity. Like gravity is pulling everything into this place. He talks about a crooked and perverse generation, that the world has pulled into this place of self-absorption, but that grace alone is the exception. Grace pushes against this. And he's saying, when you as believers of Jesus let go of your ambition and conceit, when you live in this place of service of others and generosity, when you stop grumbling about like what's being taken from you and instead living in this place of noticing and extending that love to others, you start to shine. Your heart is enlarged. You become this place of hospitality. That becomes the kind of energy that you create as you sit at the table with somebody else. You've got this compassionate space. And this is so rare in the world that we're like often struck by it when we finally see somebody with that sort of openness of heart. But Paul's like, that's what you're made for. To be these people of these like hospitable hearts. Not worried about themselves. Not thinking about and consumed with themselves, but able to really see and hold space for others. That's the non-anxious presence. Peter puts it like this. He says, the end of all things is near. Therefore, be alert and sober-minded for prayer. Above all, maintain constant love for one another, since love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaining. Just as each one has received a gift, use it to serve others as good stewards of the varied grace of God. If anyone speaks, let it be as one who speaks God's words. If anyone serves, let it be from the strength God provides, so that God may be glorified through Jesus Christ in everything. To him be the glory and power forever and ever. Amen. It's God who wills and works to his good pleasure. It's God that does it. Our effort is to let go of our control of these things and to allow God to truly speak. I have a friend that says, like, anytime she's tempted to give counsel, she's like, she just holds it and she prays. And she's like, I usually don't give people advice until it's come to mind three times. God, is this you? God, is this something you would have me say? That part of me that wants to rush in and critique or set things right. And she's going, God, would you speak through me? This like holding back of those words, pausing over that to let God speak. I'm running out of time. But if we think that like, well, this is can only be done in a world where everything's set right, let's remind ourselves that Paul's there in prison, chained to a guard 24 hours a day. We think, well, this must have been a time where the world was under good leadership. It wasn't. It was Nero. And things were about to get really bad for the church in the years to come. But there's Paul going, you know what I do? I just preach to this prisoner chained next to me. And as a result, this whole praetorian guard are becoming believers of Christ. He just sees the opportunity to shine. like stars that remind us that the world is so much bigger than we thought it was. That we as Christians can bring truth and love into this world and remind people that there is more and that they're made for more. This kind of light the world is longing for. What's the one thing we must eliminate? According to Paul, it's grumbling. When we do, when we let go of those complaints, when we let go of that mistrust and choose instead to respond with a place of openness and receptivity, what we are met by is a Father who extends grace after grace, lavishes us, fills it up, fills us with joy, not so that we can just sit there and hoard that joy, but so we can give it away. We can be these places of openness and hospitality to the world. Here's my questions for you, and then we're going to take just a minute to respond in worship. But which kind of grumbler are you? Sorry for the bluntness of that question, but I'm just assuming that at least one of those fits. A whiner, a victim, a cynic, a perfectionist, or like me, are you all four? This week, notice when you grumble, and maybe instead pray a short prayer like, I love this one, the Jesus prayer that just says, Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I'm going to skip to the last one just for the sake of time. What kind of light are you meant to shine? To whom in your life can you pour out love upon? Who can you serve? As you create space in your heart by refusing to grumble, allow God to love others through the increased capacity for his grace and love in your life. Amen.